This is Laura Calkins of the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University continuing the oral history interview with Janice Josephine Carney. Today's date is the 8th of June, 2005. I'm on the campus of Texas Tech in the Special Collections Building. And again, Janice is speaking to me by telephone. And good morning, Janice. And we've already been speaking a little bit, but I want to direct your attention right now to the time when you were actually getting very short in Vietnam. Can you describe what that was like for you?
It's really I'm kind of stubborn here. It was very okay. Mixed emotional. Kind of the last two months after we came back down from the separation up north, we were in what they call a stand down in Phu Bai. And I still had a function, obviously, because we still had a lot of people with me. And I didn't have to drive as much, but I still had a fairly busy day. But the majority of the unit really was doing nothing but smoking dope and getting drunk. We had just so much damage to our vehicles. And we just were not functioning, you know, a functioning transportation battalion. And pretty much it was all just maintenance and repair work, but they weren't running any supply missions or any real. And it got more into formal morning formations and police calls, and so a lot of there was a lot of frustration. But. You know, for me personally, you know, it just, I was, once I cracked that 90 days and then the 60 days and the final 30 days, I mean, I just, I didn't care about anything. And I was just, especially the 30 days when they gave me somebody to train. I was just, in another world. I mean, I had all kinds of, I'll call them illusions. I think it started about 90 days. I had this thing in my head that I was gonna go home, and I was gonna go back to school and finish high school. And I had that totally focused in my head.
Did it help to have some kind of goal? I mean, did it help you?
Yeah, it kept me totally focused. But the thing was, I graduated from high school.
Yeah, that's right.
And I had totally just blocked out anything doing with graduation and the prom and all that. And I totally had a fix in my head that good, I'm going to go back to school when I'm going to finish high school. And I remember when I got home the first couple of days, I said something to my mother and my brother, and they both were just kind of looking at me. And finally, my mother told me, "You graduated, don't you remember?"
That must have been a little frightening for them, too.
Yeah, they were just scared shit of me. I didn't find out, afterwards that I don't know who my mother had talked to, but she told all my brothers and sisters not to go near me. If I was sleeping, not to go near the room. And to be careful that I might still have a weapon.
Really?
Yeah. I don't know. She had talked to somebody about, and by 1971, there really was this, partially true, partly fiction, but there was this theory that all the veterans coming back were a little wacky.
And potentially dangerous.
But I had that. That whole focus in my head, that it was like, when this is over, I'm just going to go back like it never happened. I'm going to go back to high school. And that was my, my thing with going back to the world, as we called it. And when I finally got down to, my last, my last days, and I went down to, they had a friend drive me down to Cameron Bay when I finally got my orders. and I flew home out of Cameron Bay.
Mm-hmm.
But the at Cameron Bay, when you you had to do a urine specimen,
mm-hmm.
The night before your flight off, and I flunked the first one.
So this was a drug test, right?
Yes, it was like leaving Vietnam in 1971 was a little bit like getting out of prison. Actually, it was a lot like getting out of prison.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted to make sure you had no drugs. They didn't, you know, if they found anything on you, they didn't offer any kind of counseling, advice, or medical help.
Right. What did they do?
They just canceled your flight for 24 hours and said, try again tomorrow.
I mean, did...
And it would, so there were a lot of... I was lucky that... You know, I smoked some heroin off and on.
Uh-huh.
But mostly I just did marijuana.
Right.
So I didn't... And I wasn't really heavily addicted.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no major thing for me to get it out of my system.
Mm-hmm.
But there were a lot of guys that were seriously addicted to heroin.
And so presumably they're going through withdrawal?
Yeah, and all they were doing was trying to get them to a day, get it out of their system, give them a meal, and throw them on a plane.
And there was no kind of treatment or follow-up as far as you know for those
guys? No, there wasn't any, nothing. That's all they would do. Well, except for, you know, extreme cases where guys got out of control, they would put them in there. But on a whole, all they would try to do was just get them straight enough to throw them on a plane and send them home.
And so where did you spend that extra day that you had to wait? With everybody else who was waiting?
Yeah, just in the...
Was it barracks or something?
Yeah, they had a general, you know, open barracks.
Uh-huh.
Because that was just the basic... That was just all... Most people that were, you know, rotating or either way, you would just stay for 24, 48 hours, 3 days maximum usually.
And some of those guys had to be sick. I mean, I'm sure they were sick, ill.
Yeah. They were some really messed up kids. And I'll say kids. I mean, well,
yeah.
You know, 20. I was 20, 21 when I wrote it back. But we all were, you know, between anywhere from 19 to 22 was the average age. And, you know, most of us, would just right out of high school.
How easy, we talked a little bit about this before, but just to clarify, how easy had it been for you to get, to obtain heroin as opposed to marijuana? Was it more complicated?
No, it was actually for a while easier to get heroin than to get marijuana.
Really?
It was so cheap. I mean, this is 100%. They called it cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
Is what they, but it was 100% pure heroin. This stuff was wow. I mean, a lot of the GIs. You would mix it with menthol cigarettes,
mm-hmm.
and smoke it. I think most of the brothers did that. That's where I started doing it.
Okay.
And I mean, it just put you in this, I mean, laid back mood. Nothing in the world is going to bother you.
Right.
I mean, I've never. I'm not condoning it. I mean, it's. I'm just really blessed that, you know, I didn't get seriously hooked on it.
Yes, you are.
And I think with me, why I didn't get hooked on it, that it scared me, because when I was at that stone, I couldn't function. I couldn't read or think well or write, and I didn't want to be that messed up. With marijuana, you know, I was still capable of reading,
mm-hmm.
and you know, in writing. Maybe not as coherently as I thought.
Janice, had you been writing much while you were there? And what kinds of things? Letters, or were you writing things for yourself? Did you keep a journal?
Well, I was writing letters to home, and I started a journal.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to journal back then. I wasn't really... a lot of the stuff just didn't make any sense. And I had... I had all, when a couple years after I got out of the service, I had all that stuff that I wrote, and I had a bunch of maps, what I was doing, all the orders I saw, all the paperwork that I saw,
yes,
everything that crossed my hands was like quadruplet.
Mm-hmm.
And what I did, this is slightly illegal.
Uh-huh.
What I did is I took one copy just of everything,
mm-hmm.
and I had my own record system. Unbelievable stuff.
What happened to all that?
When I was living by myself in Sumber, about 2 years after my discharge,
mm-hmm.
somebody broke into my apartment, and the only thing they took was that box. It was in a closet, and nobody knew I had it but me.
So what year would this have been?
74, 75, somewhere around there.
So someone broke in and particularly took those documents as opposed to anything else
that
might have taken.
The only thing that was missing my apartment was that box.
That's a little suspicious.
Yeah, really.
I think somebody was watching you.
Most definitely.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I really was paranoid. I would put scotch tape across my door and stuff.
Uh-huh.
Little things where I could tell if somebody went in.
Right.
And when I say break in, I mean, they got in with a key.
Oh, boy.
I mean, this wasn't...
mm-hmm.
It wasn't somebody, the door was, or the window was smashed and things were turned.
Right, wasn't some kids looking for your stereo equipment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And all that. Yeah, and I had journals and stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're all gone.
Yeah, so I never really...
Wow.
And I didn't start really writing again. Until I got in therapy after, it was the early 80s when I finally got into the program in Boston,
mm-hmm.
with the Veterans Improvement Program.
The what, I'm sorry?
It was called the Veterans Improvement Program.
Okay, and this is the rap group that you were mentioning?
Yeah, it was one of I don't remember the doctor's name. The very first one I was in was in Court Street, the outpatient clinic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm kind of jumping ahead here.
That's okay.
But after I got out, I mean, the trip home was just the typical, a plane full of people in total silence. It was like coming into the country. But then I'll finish the story, but I want to.
Sure.
Well, I finally cleared the thing, and I got on my plane, and they frisk you and shake you down, and make sure you don't have any weapons or drugs or anything.
Right.
Then I had a AK-47 round around my neck, like a jewelry thing.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the guys had them, because they made them into roach clips.
Mm-hmm.
And an MP ripped that off my neck and called it contraband. Said if I wanted to discuss the issue, I can catch a later flight.
What did you reply? I'm out of here.
Yeah, gotta get said, keep it, asshole.
Yeah.
Something along that line.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And I got my flight home. The flight was it was the same way as it came in country. You want a plane full of strangers, deadly quiet. And we flew back to, we had a layover in Alaska, then down to Seattle. And in Seattle, it got to, we got issued our new dress greens and ribbons and given to us. We had a re-up talk that was a laughing riot.
I'll bet.
They laughed the guy out of the room.
God.
And then just before we left, we had a guy come in, which is the hardest part. Advise us to travel in civilian clothes, not to wear the uniform in public.
So this was an army employee.
An
officer.
Yep, I think it was a lieutenant.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of said you may not be aware of the situation that a lot of Americans are protesting and they're not proud of our accomplishments or whatever, and it will advise you for your own personal safety not to travel in a uniform.
What did that make you feel like?
it was dangerous over there. It's dangerous here. What difference does it make?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was. I'm supposed to be afraid of this, the people that I was protecting in Vietnam. Now I'm home. I'm supposed to be afraid of the average citizen. and it was the same. And I ended up traveling Seattle to Texas in my uniform. Mm-hmm. And it was. Nobody said hi. Nobody talked to you. I tried to get a drink in Texas, and they wouldn't even serve me.
Really? Where
and
were
I,
you?
And I was 21.
And you were where? At Dallas or...
It was either Dallas or San Antonio. I don't know which one we ended at.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I think it was San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what it was. I had a military ID, but I don't know what the excuse was. He wouldn't serve me.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in to one of the men's rooms. I had a caviar with a pair of jeans and a old Jesus Christ T-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus Christ Superstar.
I remember it.
Mm-hmm. And I went in to men's room, and I threw my uniform away.
You just put it in the bin?
Yeah, and I still had it. I ended up having to buy a new one.
Mm-hmm.
They were a little upset when I didn't have a Class A when I reported to Germany. And I put on the jeans and the T-shirt, mm-hmm. and went on the Saturday. By the guy even asked me for an ID. I got a beer. Guy next to me said, "Hey, how you doing? Where you from?"
Mm-hmm.
And it was like I rejoined the human race.
How much service did you have left on your commitment?
A year and a half, roughly.
Wow.
And I was, I had orders to, you know, the 30-day leave, and I had orders to go to Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up staying home a week, and I flew to Germany. I reported to Newark early, and reported to Germany early. Because I was just fighting with everybody at home, everybody, every old friend, everybody in the world. I was just in physical fights with. I was doing heroin. I got some.
In Boston?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just all... Germany kind of saved my life. I got lucky. I got an easy job over there. I worked at the Springen Airport.
Doing what?
I was an information NCO. At the information booth at Frankfurt Rhein-Main Airport.
That sounds like actually a pretty good job.
Oh. It could have made a career soldier out of me if I hadn't gone to Vietnam first. People treated you with total respect. Mm-hmm. They honored the uniform, they honored you as a person.
Mm-hmm.
So for a year and a half, it was kind of, I had problems sleeping at night, and I went to like four roommates, and they all complained that they couldn't sleep in the same room with me.
Because?
I would wake up screaming.
Okay.
It was just, and even there, they didn't. They put stuff in my records that I had a war neurosis, psychotic war neurosis.
A what kind of neurosis?
Psychotic war neurosis.
Okay.
I think what they had in my records.
Psychotic war neurosis.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was something like that, and but I, had a good time. It finished my year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
And we go back to the States. What were we talking about when I was back in the States?
You were telling me earlier about the outpatient clinic and the RAF groups.
Okay. Yeah, so what happened when I got out, I was unemployed. I went on unemployment for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And, I couldn't get a job. Yeah, I even tried to get a job, but I went on one job interview, and this guy's looking at my brief resume.
Mm-hmm.
I had worked since I was 12 years old.
Right.
I started selling newspapers and blah, 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 all through high school.
Mm-hmm.
Right out of high school, I got a job at Analog Devices, and I actually had that job when I went into the service.
Right.
And when I got out of the service, I wanted to go back to Analog Devices, but they had moved. Their offices had been in Cambridge, Mass.,
mm-hmm.
and they had moved way out to the suburbs somewhere. And I had no way of transportation or getting out there.
Right.
On the law, they had to give me my job back.
But they were too far from... You didn't have a car.
Right, I didn't have a driver's license. I just said, no way. They moved out at that time, which seemed like out in the middle of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went looking for jobs, and I went to some of the places that were always sleaziest minimum wage jobs, and they just went hiring that day. And I went to one place... And this guy's going over the resume that I could talk about. He says to me, "Well, you haven't worked in 3 years. I don't think we can hire you." And I said, wait a minute, I've been in the Army the last 3 years. That was, and he said, well, we can't consider that a job.
Okay.
And I climbed across the desk after this guy.
Uh-huh.
And he just...
Right.
And I just... And after that, I just, you know, I got the unemployment that I lived on, and I started... I got my own apartment. I was living with my brother for a while. And I got my own apartment. And once I had that privacy, I just started living as a woman.
So this would have been about, what, 74, something like that?
Yeah, 73, 74.
Okay.
And pretty much 73 and 74, I was just working as a, you know, transsexual sex worker, as we call it today.
Mm-hmm.
Affected, I think we used the term prostitute.
Mm-hmm.
And worked at a clubs in Boston. I had a personal ad in the, you know, the underground paper. And I was just drinking a lot, doing a lot of drugs, you know, prostitution. And it was just. That's what I talked about a little bit earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was just such this... I can't even think of a word to describe it. I mean, I really, really looked good. I was 5'5" and real skinny, real feminine. I had this really, really nice blonde wig.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was making... I could have made all the money I wanted. I never lacked. You know, but... I was just going back and forth. I was still having trouble with nightmares at night. And, you know, anything to do from Vietnam. Anything to do with Vietnam, I just would fly off the handle. And people just, you know, went crazy trying to figure me out. You know, I would be from this, you know, really dainty little female to this raving lunatic in a minute.
And during this time that Vietnam was all over the news, I mean, the...
Yeah, it was just building up into the fall of Saigon.
Exactly.
You know, I had seen when Quang Tri province collapsed, I know what was left of my unit was all up there.
Mm-hmm.
When they retreated all the way up south there.
Yeah.
And so, anyway, after that, this friend of my little sister's, who was 8 years younger than me,
mm-hmm.
moved in with me, and we ended up getting married, and that's the one I was married to. And I worked at a liquor store for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's a great place for an alcoholic to work.
Yeah, that sounds like not a good.
That was a good move.
Mm-hmm.
And then I took up the employment. All this stuff, the prostitution stuff, even the liquor store was a part-time.
Mm-hmm.
I was collecting unemployment. And when the girls' benefits ran out, they were trying to get me a job. And he gave me some paperwork one time to apply for an apprenticeship.
Okay.
To be a ship fitter. And I asked him what a ship fitter was, and he said they weren't sure. Some kind of kind of trade.
Right.
And I didn't know what it was either. But, I filled out all the applications for their apprenticeship program at General Dynamics,
mm-hmm.
and they actually hired me.
You're kidding, really?
Yeah. They said it was based on my high math scores.
Okay.
Which I later learned that math is very important to be a ship fitter. The ship fitter is a ship's carpenter. And you're building ships from the floor on up.
Mm-hmm.
You get to learn every blueprint. You get to learn every aspect of the ship fitting trade. You're the lead mechanic at every level. And everything has got to be within 1/32nd of an inch when bulkheads and
mm-hmm.
things are laid out.
Sure.
So it was very... the technical part of it I liked. I liked learning how to read blueprints.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a hard, real hard time. I did that for 4 years. Actually, 5 years. Because Conley missed time and we had a strike. Stopped me from ever finishing the program, and that the real masculine work, I had a horrible time, you know, lugging stuff, and I just would not physically fit for that kind of labor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I ended up after 5 years, but it was just a weird 5 years. I mean, it was like being in the Army again. I was around all these Montreal guys and the hard hat and all that, and all the drinking, and there were a lot of Vietnam veterans working there.
Mm-hmm.
So they had a lot of veterans, period. That I just got into, you know. There was a lot of just out drinking every day. And we bought a house. I ended up getting married during this time frame. And we bought a house in Howell, Mass, down by the beach. And my wife got pregnant. And that was my son, Sean.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all just really a blur. And we went out on strike. We had a big strike. And during the strike, I took a postal exam. And I got the... at that time, I had... I had 10% service-connected disability for Lyme disease.
For
what? For Lyme disease.
For Lyme disease?
Yeah.
Okay.
I had... During this time frame I worked at the shipyard,
mm-hmm.
I was in the National Guard.
Yeah, you had kept that up
the whole time? Yeah. I was in a unit at Summerville, Mass, which is where I grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And we had gone down for 2 weeks active training to Otis Air Force Base down the Cape.
Mm-hmm.
And while we were there, I got bit by a tick. And I was sick the last day I was down there. I didn't know what it was. But when I got home, I really was really bad. I had all these rashes all over my body.
Mm-hmm.
And a real fever, high fever. And
nice.
I went to Mass General Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And at first, they thought I had Rocky Mountain spotted fever. They didn't know what it was. And it was about a month later when I got a phone call from some doctor from Yale.
Mm-hmm.
And she had read my case or something. And it was a big article in the New York Times about Lyme disease on the Cape.
Oh, boy.
And he wanted some samples of my blood.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he diagnosed and he started me on a whole different treatment.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really, my knees and my back, my spine and my neck,
yeah.
I was just in constant pain in the joints.
Oh, boy.
And at the time, I was petrified I was going to be like this the rest of my life. And I couldn't work. I was still working at the shipyard, but I was out on sick for this.
Mm-hmm.
And it really looked like I was never going to be able to go back to work. So when I started the treatment that they recommended, I started getting better. But I had taken the postal exam, and I ended up going to the post office and not going back to the shipyard.
So where were you working for the post office?
In Boston, the postal annex. The first year, I kind of bounced around, which is what you do. I worked in Cambridge for a while. And when I got a regular position in a couple years of the Army, I ended up at the sub-postal annex. That's where I worked for years. And
Until about when?
90 to 91.
Okay.
It was not 91 when I had the incident. But I'd been in the post office. With the Lyme disease, I ended up going to... Somebody in the guard unit sent me to somebody at the VA to talk to.
Mm-hmm.
And they actually gave me a 10% disability from the Lyme disease.
Because
it occurred on active duty.
Mm-hmm. And what did that actually mean? Did you get...
It cracked me up. I mean, these people didn't get it. Why I thought it was... hilarious.
Uh-huh.
I said, you're in Vietnam, but
yeah.
I don't get any disability, but a weekend being drunk down in the Cape and I get a service connected disability.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was hilarious. I really did.
Well, it's ironic, that's for sure.
Yeah, but anyway, they because I had a 10%, I joined the DAV,
mm-hmm.
the Disabled American Veterans,
mm-hmm.
and it also gave me the extra points on the postal exam.
Oh,
10
okay.
extra points.
Uh huh. Sure.
And but the DAV, because I gave them, you know, rights to get my records and stuff.
Yeah.
When you sign over your rights to them.
Yeah.
And it took him a while to get all my medical records. Mm-hmm. And by that time, I was in the post office. And one day, the guy that was hailing my records asked me to come over and wanted to sit down and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he asked me if I was aware that I had 2 0% disabilities. And I said no. And he had my records, and he showed me I had a 0% disability for what they call psychotic. They showed a term with psychotic wonderfulness.
Mm-hmm.
How they worked it. And I had 0% disability for the hearing losses. And he asked me if I still was having any problems with Vietnam or nightmares or anything. And I looked at this guy. I said, "Are you serious? Who the fuck does it?" And my attitude was, "Doesn't everybody?"
Right. Exactly. Yeah. You didn't really know.
Yeah. I started mm-hmm. saying, "This guy, were you in Vietnam?" And this guy was a Marine, and he knew, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then he asked me if I had ringing in my ears, and I said, "Yeah, constantly." And that was the thing. When I got the job at the shipyard,
mm-hmm.
I remember going back to that. I flunked their physical because of my hearing, and I almost didn't get the job. And I had to sign a waiver saying that my hearing already was damaged and that I wouldn't hold them responsible for any hearing loss at the yard.
It's sort of like when you were going through the physical for the Army and you're blind in one eye, legally blind,
yeah.
And they just said, "Okay, good enough,"
yeah.
Or whatever, pass you through.
Yeah, yeah. You know, their attitude, as long as I was going to hold them liable for any damage to my ears,
they could continue to damage your ears.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Well, you can come in here and work 5 or 10 years, and when you're deaf, we'll let you go.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I'm seeing that. Yeah. So with these 0% disability things already in your record, what options were open to you? Did he explain to you?
Oh yeah, he said he just asked me to sign a paper to reopen both claims. And right off the, you know, it took, I don't know, real quick actually at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was about 6 months I got a letter from the VA. They didn't even call me in for an evaluation, which is really just based on my medical records. And I was lucky because I had this stuff. I mean, at the DAV got it, and my records were well kept.
Yes.
Because if this stuff was not in my records, you know, that I was treated for hearing in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And there was some notes in there from doctors, you were active duty, saying, implying that I had a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So I had all this documentation. And he gave me, I forgot what it was at first, I think it was 10% for post-traumatic stress disorder. That's the first time they used that language.
Mm-hmm.
And 20% for the hearing for tinnitus. And so I had a, and I had, only took, yeah, it was weird the way they did it, but they took away the Lyme disease and said my arthritis was cured.
But gave you 10 and then
and 20. But they gave me, I was getting 10% for the Lyme disease.
Yes.
But they gave me a 30% disability, but both of these disabilities were service connected to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. How did it happen that you later moved to 100%. I mean, I'm sure it's complicated. I know that.
Well, this gets into the post office and what happened.
Okay. And you can either talk about it or not, Janice, whichever you prefer.
Well, it...
Or just give
it
us
It builds
a sense
up
of it.
What happened when I got into the post office. In 1978...
Mm-hmm.
It was 78 or 79, somewhere around there. Yeah, that'll be right. So we go into the early 80s,
mm-hmm.
as I had been in the post office a few years.
Mm-hmm.
I was just missing a lot of time. And I ended up one night just totally burnt out. I was working nights, you know, sleeping during the day and doing a lot of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of liked that because I was in that pattern. I didn't like. I liked working nights, but it was really hot. And sleeping during the day was a sense of comfort. Cause I had always had trouble sleeping at night.
Right.
And but I was just constantly, arguing with people. But outside of Vietnam, but this time, it was like living in two worlds. I was doing a lot of cross-dressing. I had that side of it, but I was very figurative about it.
Mm-hmm.
And in work, I hung around with nothing but the Vietnam veterans. And it was like two different personalities in both places.
Mm-hmm.
And the image, and I was just constantly, like the Army and the Reserve, and it all just exploded. And I ended up, they took me out one night and brought me to the VA.
Mm-hmm.
They recommended that I get some counseling. And that saved my job. And DV Value brought me up to 50%.
Okay.
For the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay.
And I started this group. That was the original group, was in the Court Street outpatient clinic in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a doctor that was really pioneering in post-traumatic stress disorder. I really don't remember his name. He ended up leaving the VA, and he threw it to some college somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But he really seemed to have kind of a program together.
Right.
And he managed to control us. He was a veteran, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he left, and some a nurse's aide, I'm not sure what this guy's training was, and a nurse took the program over. And neither one of them had ever served in the military.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't think either one of them knew anything about post-traumatic stress either. But it just got totally out of control. And we would all meet before the sessions and get stoned.
Wow.
And just make fun of them.
Mm-hmm. Were these mandatory sessions?
Yeah, pretty much we all were threatened with, if we didn't show up, we would be put locked up for with the 90 days observation.
Right.
What they call, what they call a red tag or whatever. It happened to me a couple of times, and I just didn't want to do it again. Well, all they do is just put you up in Jamaica Plain, what they call the flight deck, and put you on Thorazine. That's all they were doing.
Put you on Thorazine?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
For about 90 days, and,
cool you out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That was what they would do. And that's the way they would, the main treatment they would do for Vietnam veterans that didn't, that weren't docile following the program.
Oh, my God, yeah. Uh-huh.
And, one day, somehow my pants caught on fire. I don't know if somebody was smoking a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so stoned, I didn't even know it. I had a pair of jeans on with, the strings coming down.
Yeah.
And they realized that they just couldn't control us. And they ended the program. And they put us all in individual therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried to keep us even from communicating with each other.
Did you consider these guys who were all in this, all in the same boat with you, friends?
Oh, yeah. It was like, my platoon.
Okay.
I mean, it was mm-hmm. the, it was kind of like the only safety net I had. And that's when I learned a lot about, it's like years later when I met other trans people
mm-hmm.
and realized I wasn't, alone.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same thing. I was finding out all these guys had the same problems, with drugs and alcohol and nightmares, that I wasn't the only one that came back and was, with all these problems.
And on some level, was that kind of reassuring? I mean, I get that the problems were there, but not being alone with it is pretty important.
Yeah, there was this kind of... But what happened is, over a course, I think about a year, about half the guys in that program committed suicide successfully. I mean, the suicide rate was just phenomenal. And I had one suicide attempt. And they just didn't know what to do. And we all were just in individual therapy. And they started a new clinic, which was the... Veterans History Program.
Mm-hmm.
That was all for post-traumatic stress disorder and drug abuse. And then they put us all in that program. And that program was much better. It was just so organized and so much. It was a real program.
Like there was structure to it?
Yeah, really, really structured.
Okay.
There was drug control. You don't know when you're going to be tested.
Okay.
People, they put me on, what's the drug? There was a drug that they used to take, if you drank alcohol, it would make you real violently sick.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I can't remember the name, but I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, but they, you know, they made me take it, and it literally, you have to go over every day, you know, the 5 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy made sure I took it, Jim Morrell.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got some sobriety out of that, and it got involved with a lot of people. And it started, it took it took me well up into the 80s to really get sober after bouncing back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up during a time frame, I had two more suicide attempts. And I had one more. And they just, you know, kept on getting worse at the post office. And they took me to the hospital one day.
Mm-hmm.
After there was a guy named Jimmy Hunter. He was another Vietnam veteran.
Mm-hmm.
He had a mail order bride from Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And he killed her. And he stole a plane and flew over Boston with an AK-47. And this was 1991.
Mm-hmm.
And when he came down, they had all the trial. He tried to claim post-traumatic stress disorder, but it didn't work, and it shouldn't. He was just a nut.
Did they send him to prison?
Yeah, he ended up.
Regular population?
Yeah, they sent him to. Okay, he was in the same prison my father was in.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you call it? It's like Monica Hospital for the criminally insane.
Okay.
In,
mm-hmm.
in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get the name right now. It's outside of Boston, and it's mostly really for people that they didn't find him incompetent because of post-traumatic stress disorder, but they found him criminally insane.
Okay.
And I think he was in there at the same time as my father. We had a lot of problems.
So your father had been getting worse all this time.
Yeah, he was really whipped brain, and he had been accused of having sex with local kids with boy pedophilia,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, went back to when my older brother's claims where he taught it, and it's the whole dominable theory, but I don't want to talk about it.
That's okay. That's fine. That's fine.
What do I think? So, anyway, I ended up not too long after that incident.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of so much stuff going on in the post office of Vietnam veterans.
Mm-hmm.
Going over the edge. And the running jokes about going postal.
Yeah.
I mean, it just got impossible to be a Vietnam veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder and working for the post office. Just didn't work.
The pressures were coming from too many places.
Yeah, I would get constant jokes and dropping things behind me, and, you know, the rumors going around. There was a pool going on, people picking dates when he thought I was going to go over the edge. You know, the postal inspectors came and arrested me one time when I was coming to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they were waiting for me to come in because they wanted to go to my locker because somebody said they saw an AK-47 in my locker.
Good God.
And it did. It just got. And it ended up with them finally taking me out after I got into an argument with my supervisor,
mm-hmm.
one of the up team ones. But this time I did kind of threaten them.
Right.
And when he took me over to the VA to the mental program I was in, that's when their doctor, I'm trying to think, but the, yeah, but by this time I had gone from, yeah, to 0 to 20 to 30. I was up to 50% for the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they recommended me for the 100%. And the doctors at the VA even wrote up a report saying they felt that I was unfit to work because of the worsening post-traumatic stress disorder. And he ended up, I had no choice but to take the 40% disability retirement.
From the post office.
Right.
Uh-huh.
But that opened up the VA for my claim. It took 5 years and 3 appeals, but he ended up giving me the 100% for the post-traumatic stress disorder.
Who managed all of those appeals? I mean, did you run that yourself? I can't imagine the amount of work and paperwork and
It was the DAV representative.
The DAV did. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
What happened is they tried to, locally, the regional,
mm-hmm.
They kept on trying to say that my post-traumatic stress disorder was from the post office, not from Vietnam. How's that for a defense?
Well, it boggles the mind, really.
But that was their story, and that was the second one. First, they tried to say that my whole problem was I was an alcoholic. And this is what they use a lot.
Right.
They would try to say that my problems were related to alcohol abuse, not to my military duty.
And seeing no connection between those two things.
Right. That would be the way the people that, the pencil pushers, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah.
When it was very clear in my records, from Dr. By this time I was seeing Dr. Shea.
Mm-hmm.
And he was my primary doctor.
Now, this is Jonathan Shea.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he made it very clear that alcohol and drug abuse was a secondary symptom of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Sure.
They coordinate into you. And he was the one that finally got me to a point of really, getting sober. And I learned the hard way that alcohol and antidepressants and all these other drugs, and trazodone,
mm-hmm.
even going to the therapy, you're still playing games. You're never gonna. It took me close to 10 years of treatment to finally catch on.
What were those years? I mean, when would you say that you did finally, figure out that all of the chemicals were probably...
Well, 1996. And mm-hmm. 1991 was when I left the post office.
Mm-hmm.
And I, 88, I went... It was 88, 89. 88, I was going to college part-time.
That's when you started your degree work?
Yeah, the first part of it was they had a program that for veterans that had just had a high school diploma,
right,
and nothing else,
mm-hmm.
and had been I'd been out of high school 20 years, and they would give you a refresher course. It was a 14-week course,
mm-hmm.
On the basics,
right,
and if you passed that, you would automatically be accepted into UMass.
So you started that in 1988?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Uh-huh.
And
when did you actually take your degree?
Actually, I'm trying to... I can go look at my diploma.
That's okay.
No, I'm right here.
Okay.
They put on that.
And this was a BA in law?
Yeah. What do you put? Yeah, 93 was when I finally earned it,
mm-hmm.
yeah. Bachelor of Arts in Law Studies.
That's not bad.
Yeah,
given everything, everything else that was going on.
But I started it, when I was working to work at the post office part time.
Mm-hmm.
And by that time I had a day job, and then I was taking courses at night.
Mm-hmm.
But when I left in 1991,
mm-hmm.
I started kind of going full time. I was still, still drinking, so I was still a functioning alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And that went up to 93 when I earned a degree. And my goal was to do legal research, and I really got really much invested in family law. I took a couple of courses at UMass with I was trying to get into women's studies, and he wouldn't let me in some of that stuff.
Yeah, some of the stuff we talked about a little bit.
Yeah, and but I really got into family law. And some of the courses I took, I was the only man,
mm-hmm.
In some of these courses.
Oh,
and
I believe that.
And it was one one course, it was a really high course feminist. I was amazed that she passed me. I mean, she was quite, did not, you know, I was, you know, she was not ready for this kind of change.
You weren't fitting her profile.
No, but I just learned so much, and it was what I knew all along, that women get screwed in most cases,
sure.
And it's in between a woman and children end up, you know, the highest poverty levels and all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an administrative law dealing with people with disabilities trying to get Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the real key things I was interested in. But when I finished the BA program and tried to go out and get a job, the VA, I knew the way it works, because Voc Rehab paid for all this, the vocational rehab.
Mm-hmm.
And the theory is that instead of paying me the rest of my life, you know, to do nothing,
right,
that I would get back in the workforce, and my disability would be reevaluated and go down. And that's what I wanted. I didn't want to be 100% disabled for the rest of my life. I wanted to do something.
And
I just started, I went to all kinds of, I lost track of how many interviews I had trying to get into law firms doing legal research.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to do. Because legal research, you work at your own pace, and the bulk of the work you're doing is in a library.
Sure.
And it was almost like going back to my childhood, you know, hanging with the library.
That's right, yeah.
And, I just, nobody would touch me. Nobody would give me a chance. I even tried some volunteer stuff.
No one would hire you because they knew about the 100% PTSD?
Yeah.
And they just made assumptions about whether the degree to which you might be able to cope?
Yeah.
Would they tell you this, Janice? I mean,
oh, no. They just...
Okay, so it's all behind the curtain.
Yeah, we're getting into the era of the Disabilities Act.
Absolutely, yeah.
Age, and a lot of it, by this time it was closing in on, if it wasn't 50, it was closing in on 50.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to, you know, somebody in their, you know, late 40s, and somebody would, a disabled Vietnam veteran, a post-traumatic stress disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And the VA even finally, because they were the ones that were, pushing for this, for Voc Rehab.
Right.
And what they finally did is they closed my folder.
What does that mean?
They declared me totally unemployable, 100% total and permanent. And they stopped. They told me that they just can't help me get a job. And the counselor was really, nice. He said, "You know, and I know it's total discrimination, but we can't prove it. And we have so many people we can get jobs that we just can't spend the time."
So at that point, he
was just adamant that nobody, at that time I still came across as very nervous. I would shake at times, and I was under a lot of medication.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just adamant nobody was going to hire me.
So the VA made an administrative decision about your permanent incapacity at this point.
Yeah, that's okay. Basically once you had 100% for over 5 years, you could be declared total and permanent. And unemployable, and once you get that label, they don't evaluate you anymore. You're, as far as they're concerned, you're not functional.
Hmm. Well, we know that's not true. I mean, at some point, I mean, it's not true in terms of your functionality. I mean, you're clearly very, very functional. Janice, when did the Agent Orange litigation that you're involved with begin?
That was in the middle 80s, too.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I got involved with that because my son was born. My wife had a real tough pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
Real tough. And my son was born with a lot of problems.
Okay.
Learning disabilities. He was born, but he, as he was growing up,
mm-hmm.
and a lot of it was from my post-traumatic stress disorder, but two issues. And we went through the 80s, where my wife had a couple of miscarriages,
mm-hmm.
and one where she was, the just something with her eyes that she could have gone blind. It was something bizarre, I don't know. But I had started doing research, on the Agent Orange stuff when it was coming out.
Yeah.
And that was one of the biggest things that kids, children of Vietnam veterans, the kids being born with different disabilities and learning disabilities and the wives miscarrying.
Absolutely, yeah.
And that's how I got involved with it. And being in Boston, they were having different hearings, and I forgot what position Kerry was in at that time. He held some state, I don't know if he was a state senator, what job he had, you know, John Kerry.
Mm-hmm.
But he was having some kind of hearings on it.
Probably, I think he was a U.S. senator even back then.
Maybe he was a senator, I don't remember. But he started as lieutenant governor.
Uh-huh, yes.
Didn't even, but anyway, he was having some hearings on it, and I got involved with that.
Uh-huh.
And I knew other veterans that were. And that's when, you know, I requested my copies of my records.
Okay.
And when he ended the information, Freedom of Information Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I got a bunch of stuff from Operation Ranch Hand. And I showed all that the whole area I was in Quantry
mm-hmm.
had been heavily sprayed. And the areas where I was driving, they were hand spraying. They would, you know, they'd be hand spraying the side of the road right up to, sometimes even when I was driving through it. I didn't know what they were doing at the time.
Sure, of course not.
But I had gotten all this information, and the class action suit was going on, and I had my name listed on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's how I got on and got involved with it. But and then when it went on so long, I kind of, you know, put the back door on. But when he finally reached a settlement, and I got some letters saying that I wasn't eligible for any financial assistance because I was in areas that weren't sprayed. It was from this court-appointed judge, and I think it was out of New York.
And this is the point at which you wrote him a polite letter?
Yeah, I wrote him a very polite letter, and I sent him copies of all this stuff.
Mm-hmm. That you had gotten through FOIA.
Right, I had already had it.
Yes.
And, you know, I just kind of said, have you done any research? I included copies of my orders, you know, my record showing where I served,
mm-hmm.
and maps showing where they were sprayed. And, you know, I kind of, you know, said, you put two and two together. You know, I listed my duties, and you know, that I was driving for all this stuff.
Absolutely. Uh-huh.
I said, you know, and the thing was, I think all this judge did is he looked at my name, and he looked at bill clerk, and, you know, that's all he did. He said, bill clerk, you know, he couldn't have, what could he have?
Yeah, how could he be exposed? Yeah, right.
Yeah. This is just weird for me. I haven't referred to myself in here in a long time.
mm-hmm. Well, someone else was referring to you at that.
Yeah, somebody was, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that was how, in the end, he reviewed it, and I forgot what I got. I got three checks, so I got $1,500 each, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which was about the average of the settlement, the way the settlement was broken down.
Yeah. That's not a lot of money, though.
Oh, no. If you know, and they never answered any questions. I mean, for a lot of people, that was, they never answered any questions about Agent Orange. I mean, I still, I just lost a friend actually a couple of weeks ago. That, I think it died from complications from Agent Orange. She had a lot of problems.
Hmm.
She was another transgender woman that served in Vietnam. She was a member of TAVA.
And she served.
She died a couple of weeks ago.
In which branch, do you know?
She was in the Army and Marines.
Really?
Yeah, she actually did two tours of Vietnam, one in the Army, one in the Marines. I was very lucky that last year's TAVA, you may have met her, you was at the first
yes.
TAVA. You was at the woman that was in the wheelchair, the automated wheelchair, you know?
Out at the wall? Or out
yeah,
at
she
the...
was at she went in the wall.
Uh-huh, okay. Yeah, I remember seeing her.
Yeah, her. And that was part of what her problems were, with her spine and different things.
Mm-hmm.
They were connected to Agent Orange.
Oh, boy, that's sad news.
Yeah, it was just a couple of days before Memorial Day. And that was kind of, in that Memorial Day poem, you can see near the end, I talk about just receiving an email.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
what I was talking about.
Oh, boy.
I've problems I have with my lungs and water built up,
mm-hmm.
that I've had doctors for the last 10 years telling me how bad my lungs are,
mm-hmm.
and the VA doctors keep blaming it on cigarettes, and I keep telling them I never smoked, and, you know, private doctors have said it's probably damage from Agent Orange.
And Are the VA doctors not believing you when you say you didn't smoke? Or they, do they just...
Well, they just kind of shrug it off.
Oh.
You know? I mean, it's... I have 100% service connected disability. That's all. You can't get 101.
Right, but in terms of treating you.
Yeah, but that's exactly I'm talking about.
Exactly.
They treat it and they tell me I have real bad lungs and they don't want to get into why, but
right.
That they every time I get congested now, I go right over there
to make sure that you don't get pneumonia.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. I get all. Bronchial infections and it gets in.
Right, once it gets started, it's bad.
No, it's there's just so much stuff about age, which we still don't know. And they don't. But they're so busy now, they have a whole other can of worms with all the chemicals in Iraq and Kuwait. And
right. Yes, all of this. Do you think that enough... funds are being directed to either research in these areas or treatment of veterans? I mean, I know this is an issue that I've heard you speak publicly about, and I think it would be useful to put your views down about differences within the VA in treatment and from region to region, as well as sort of the general policy questions of whether they're appropriately funded or not.
Well, it's so much of this stuff just goes from region to region.
Uh-huh.
And it goes in how... especially with issues on how they treat transgender veterans.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. And one way to start that, Janice, is just to clarify what I think it was, I think you said earlier, sometime in the late 19 or mid-1990s maybe because of the Internet and so forth, you were able to get more information about transgender issues and you started to sort of see yourself there.
Yeah. What happened... with me in 1996.
Mm-hmm.
That was my last suicide attempt.
Okay.
And I was dressed up. My family was gone on a ski trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I got dressed up. I had to tell myself, for the second time, I'm never going to do it again. And I was listening to Tom Jones. And I took a bunch of medications and just laid down.
Right.
And my daughter found me, and they called 911, and so I got to fight with the ambulance people because I didn't want to go to the hospital. And they ended up taking me to the emergency ward in New Hampshire.
Mm-hmm. This is New Hampshire, yeah.
Yeah, and they pumped my stomach out, and
yes.
Actually, really, if there was no question at the time, I probably would have had my successful suicide attempt
mm-hmm.
if they hadn't found me and got me to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And... they kept me there for a couple of days, and they sent me down. They took me by ambulance down to the VA hospital in Jamaica Plain for another 90 days of bliss.
Of Thorazine bliss?
Yeah, by this time they had stopped using Thorazine.
Okay.
It was different. And but they really, my wife that told me I couldn't come back in the house,
mm-hmm.
and the marriage was really over by this time.
Mm-hmm.
She had a boyfriend and had her own life.
And you had two kids?
We had three kids.
Three kids.
Eight or seven. It was like 10 years in between my son and my two daughters.
Uh-huh.
And I had back-to-back. Those were my two daughters. And it ended up, I think in the VA, the program I was in, they told me they were going to throw me out of the program. That they were just done. But all these years, I did give me too many breaks. With still abusing drugs and alcohol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it just looked like, my whole world was falling apart. And a friend of mine from my church, she knew this guy. That worked at the post office. It was a Vietnam veteran. He actually served 101st Airborne,
mm-hmm.
my unit.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd been in AA for years. And she asked him to come and talk to me. And he ended up becoming my sponsor. And I went right into AA from, when I got out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And I ended up going back with my wife for a while. But anyway, I ended up putting a year of sobriety together. And he let me back, you know, in the veterans program.
Mm-hmm.
And after a year of sobriety, when I was talking to my sponsor, and by this time I had my personal counselor at the VA, Chris McCary was her name.
Mick
McCary.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
She came out. I shouldn't put this into whatever. She came out to me as a lesbian.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of thought she was, but she was working for the VA. She was kind of very, especially dealing with Vietnam veterans.
Yeah, kind of quiet about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't,
mm-hmm.
But she got me to talk more about other things. And Dr. Shea did the same thing. I mean, this whole time frame after my first year of sobriety, when I was worrying about staying sober and trying to do a fourth step and figure out getting a year of sobriety is easier than your second year.
Mm-hmm.
This is just my personal opinion, but okay. I really believe that, because you get into trying to stay sober for a number of years, you got to admit that there's something wrong with you.
Right.
At least this is the 12-step theory.
Mm-hmm.
It would four-step personal inventories, and why do you feel this need? And especially if you have suicidal tendencies, why? It's all looking into yourself and spiritual. Why? Why do you feel you're better off dead? I mean, and I had always, up until this point, used Vietnam as my crutch,
mm-hmm.
and I never talked to anybody about how I felt about the transgender issues. And the sponsor was the first person that I told.
Mm-hmm.
And he just totally amazed me. He said, if women's clothes is going to stop you from wanting to kill yourself and keep you sober, go shopping. What's your problem?
Mm-hmm.
And pretty much Chris was telling me the same thing. And she was introduced me to a lot of websites. She was not that familiar with transgender issues. But being active in the gay and lesbian rights,
mm-hmm.
she got different things. And she put me to a lot of websites and stuff. And during this time frame, too, the VA, they put me in a program where I can get a computer.
Mm-hmm.
I never had a computer. And I was living by myself. This is a place separated from my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And they were afraid I was really isolating.
Which was not good.
No. After mm-hmm. I was with my wife for 25 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Common years we lived together in a marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden I was living in a basement apartment by myself. And, obviously somebody, my whole prior history.
Yes, exactly.
And, so they got me this computer, and at first I thought it was just going to be, a used thing, but I just couldn't believe it. When I, it was all brand new, all Dell with a big, what do you call the TV part of it?
The monitor?
Yeah, it was a huge
mm-hmm.
monitor,
because mm-hmm.
I had bad eyes.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly.
And everything, it was all brand new, Dell with all the equipment, real high tech.
Wow.
My son came over and put it all together for me.
Mm-hmm.
My son was just fascinated. He couldn't believe that even they gave you this.
And this came to you through the VA?
Yeah, it was through a VA program in Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a program just for 100% disabled, total and permanent veterans.
Right.
To try to get them, the idea was through the computer and the internet, that they could make friends and
pursue interests.
And along that.
Get engaged.
Right. I think if they knew, I don't know if they would have given it to me if they knew my sole purpose was to get transgender information. But
well, probably not. Probably not.
But a lot of it, a lot of the guys I know that used them, they had contact with other Vietnam veterans, and
mm-hmm.
that was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, after I got that and they paid for tutoring, I had a tutor come in.
Uh-huh.
And
to teach you how to use it.
Yeah. And it opened up right from day one. That really was one of the first things I did. Was hit transgender. I was just getting familiar with the term. Wasn't even sure what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, when I got the computer, I was living as from from the time I left my wife, I'm going to backtrack.
It's okay.
Mm-hmm. 1997. I left New Hampshire, went down to Boston for a year in Garden Apartments.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the apartment for about a month, and I just went out one day and went down to the Goodwill store. Then I bought a bunch of, just went nuts. It was all cheap clothes. I went nuts, bought a couple of big bags of all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Went back to my apartment and took all my men's clothes, put them back in the two bags, and Friday night put on what I thought looked best in my summer dress.
Mm-hmm.
They had old daisies on it. It was a nice summer dress.
Mm-hmm.
And a pair of sandals. And then went back to the Goodwill store and made a donation on all my men's clothes.
Wow.
The same person was there that just saw me buy all the other stuff.
Right.
And she just kind of had this look on her face. Okay.
I'm glad she did.
But, you know, all my life, at least I had done this purge, but I always purged on the female clothes. This is the first time I actually purged on my male clothes and said I'm never going to wear men's clothes again.
Wow.
And I went over, got a cup of coffee, and but this time I didn't have the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a little information about the International Federation for Gender Education.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I was just totally going blind. I went to a doctor outside of Boston and had some hormone tests done. And he told me that I had a lot of estrogen.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that the imbalance may have been what was causing a lot of my depression and my lack of sex drive.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted me to start taking some Tovazine. What's a male hormone?
Testosterone.
Yeah, I have a hard time saying that word.
Mm-hmm.
I can say estrogen.
I think that's a sign, too, anyway. So he wanted you to take shots or pills?
Yeah,
or
he wanted me to go on male hormone.
Uh-huh.
And his exact language was, it'll bring back your male aggression and your sex drive. And, you know, I just kind of looked at him saying, well, I don't want that.
Why would I want that? Right.
Leave me alone. Uh-huh. I even said something to him once. I don't think I ever actually had any male aggression. You could look at that as a problem. I don't look at it as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the doctors at the VA didn't know anything. They recommended that I go to a Fenway clinic. So I went to the other clinic in Boston.
Yeah, Fenway.
Yeah, uh-huh. If you're familiar with the Fenway
mm-hmm.
clinic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw a nurse there, and they took more blood types and stuff. And she asked me what I prefer, and I said I'd rather go on an estrogen program. And she told me about the program, and she was just so neat. She just kind of looked at me and everything. They had a tough program. They were, a little too tough. And she did my height and weight and all this other kind of stuff, and
mm-hmm.
looked at my hands and feet, and really was looking for other feminine qualities.
Mm-hmm.
Would not all transgender women have to a certain extreme?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And but she said, "Yeah, you're a great candidate for our program," and she got me into the support group and stuff.
So
I had to wait mm-hmm. a year before they put me on an estrogen program.
And was that a protocol that they had internally that you had
to? Yeah, but that's mm-hmm. the procedure for just about all treatments. And
mm-hmm. and just to explain the reason for that for someone who wouldn't get that, why would they want to do that? Like to make sure.
To make sure. There's a fair amount of people with other issues. A fair amount of gay men that, because of their religious upbringing,
mm-hmm.
They get it drilled into the head that being gay is bad and evil. And there are a lot of documented cases where the family came in will say, well, maybe I'm a transsexual. If I have sex, then I can have sex with men,
mm-hmm.
then I won't be, I can still go to church.
So it's just,
and these other things, but that's one of the key red flags. And there are people that are just, cross-dressers, and they too kind of doctors say, well, if you're just comfortable with wearing clothes once in a while, and these several factors, and the transgender is such a vague umbrella of people.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get into therapy, with these issues, there really is a minority in the transgender community that are actually found as to be clinically with what they call gender dysphoria or gender identity crisis.
Yeah.
That qualify for that extreme of hormone treatments and then,
Then
body altering surgeries.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because it's the hormone treatment ain't bad. That can be reversed.
Right.
But once you do any of these adult gender altering surgeries,
right? This is a life commitment.
Right.
Life
all,
change.
Yeah.
And your obviously your transition has been one that you're completely comfortable with. I know that from meeting you. And your interests now include working with and being associated with other transgendered veterans.
Yeah, really myself. We founded our own organization, Monica Helms, and Angela Brightfeather, who are actually the co-founders
of TAVA,
the Transgender American Veterans Association.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been involved with it from the very, very beginning, and even before the beginnings on going back several years ago when we were trying to have a transgender march on Washington, similar to the lesbian and gay marches.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And that never got off the ground. We just couldn't get that organized. But from the roots of that, I proposed having a transgender veterans march on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, and this is from the roots of where the concepts of TAVA came from.
Mm-hmm.
But I really had this vision of transgendered veterans from all around the country with a bus from every state and a real massive demonstration at the Vietnam Memorial.
Because
I would love to. I just had this huge vision that in the far right attacking us in. And I just couldn't see how, they would get away with it when we were all veterans.
It would make it more difficult for
them.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Just because we're transgender, we're still veterans that served in our country.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And that was my vision. Well, we never just got... But TAVA, which is existing, has had two conferences in Washington, is doing well and growing.
Any estimate? I mean, are you on the board? Jan?
Yeah, I'm on the board of directors.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And about how many active, whether they're members or not, I don't know if you make that distinction, but about how many active people associated with TAVA at this point?
I think there's around 60.
Wow.
We say active.
Mm-hmm.
There's more. I would say around 60.
Okay.
That are on a regular that are listed as members.
Mm-hmm.
And.
And tell me about the visit to the wall and that TAVA made. Was it last year, in 2004, or to the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier?
Yeah, that was last year. Was the first one, and you had to repeat this year that there weren't as many people.
Okay,
but last year's was the first, and it was probably highly emotional I don't know if it's psychological, but I had been to the wall before as Janice, as a female.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if it's estrogens or psychology or just my own maturity, that the first time I just found it so much easier to cry. And I don't know if it's a combination of all of those or much more from the stonic approach that I usually had when I went to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, the transgender veterans just so emotional, so much more emotional than going with a bunch of guys who kind of, they'll pat each other on the back and kind of look about, say, gee, should I hug them?
Mm-hmm.
These that kind of standoffish.
Right, because of gender roles.
Right, right.
Uh-huh.
It's so embedded in the military and in here.
Right.
And it was just so much of an emotional trip. And when going to the Too Many Unknown Soldier, we actually did draw straws kind of thing. because it would too would actually bring up the wreath.
Yes.
And but just the fact that we got to, that there was an issue over this a few years ago over a gay veterans group that they wouldn't let them.
That Arlington.
Yeah, the
people would not.
Yeah, let them put a wreath at the tomb of their own soldier.
Mm-hmm.
They ended up winning, but they had a much harder time.
Yes.
What
did you guys encounter? What did Cava encounter?
We had no real problem up until the really end. When the wreath arrived, it said transgender veterans.
Mm-hmm.
The wreath disappeared for a while. The wreaths arrive right in these, like, a back room where the honor guide is.
Mm-hmm.
And they arrive that morning. And they just go to these things right behind each other.
Right, they have multiple ceremonials lined up.
Right.
Uh-huh.
all day, they may have, a couple of dozen
sure.
organizations that are putting wreaths on personal people.
Yes.
And you've got to schedule for these things, you know, well in advance.
Yes.
And I think we were just listed as Tava all along. And they just thought it was, you know, maybe they thought we were the Tallahassee American Veterans Association.
Right.
And when the wreath arrived and said Transgender American Veterans Association, we think somebody kind of, you know, tried to bury it in the back somewhere. They claimed that they didn't have it just shortly before the ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And Angela, because I was up arranging all this stuff, and I had a cell phone, and I had to call back to get Angela.
And who's Angela?
Angela Brightfeather is the
co-founder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Angela and Monica basically
right.
are the founders,
mm-hmm.
and the president and the activities coordinator for the Titus.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a big woman,
mm-hmm.
and she was a DI.
Mm-hmm.
And she pulls no punches.
mm-hmm.
And she called immediately the commander on the honor guide. You know, advise him of the situation that the honor guide is saying our wreath is not there. And I guess they found it real quick. Real quick. Yeah. But that was the only, you know, and the ceremony went without an issue.
But even within this whole experience, of course, you're still getting what felt like whether it was intentional or not, you know, isn't really established, but it felt like discrimination from active duty personnel. I mean, is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, Corinne said it was deliberate.
Mm-hmm.
That they just, it goes back to the homophobia, transphobia attitude, you know, even in the honor guard,
right.
Which is, so, you know, well, you can't get more military than the honor guard. You know, the whole, you know, ultimate uniform thing.
Mm-hmm.
And but you know, to actually have the honor guard lady read it, to introduce us and salute and to read it, and in reality, I mean, they were admitting that the, you know, transgender veterans have given the ultimate sacrifice for their country. That was what it was all about.
Janice, let me ask you about other public ceremonies that you've gone to, ceremonies that are connected to military service, like Memorial Day ceremonies or Veterans Day. Yesterday, you mentioned to me outside of the interview that you've had some strange reactions to your appearance at some of these ceremonies over the years, last couple, 3 years or 4 years. Can you tell me anything about those?
The realization has come to me that I kind of knew subconsciously that women's veterans are treated differently from men's veterans.
Mm-hmm.
But I just seen it so firsthand from all the years, especially up in southern New Hampshire, in Derry, New Hampshire, where I lived in
yes.
Salem,
uh-huh.
where you know, for several years, every Memorial Day, every Veterans Day, I've gone to different ceremonies. And would wear either my uniform or a hat with my ribbons on it. I would wear something that totally recognizable as a decorated Vietnam veteran. Mm-hmm. And all the years with, you know, male clothes and with the appearance, I would always have people shaking my hand, asking me where I served, and reporters asking me questions.
Right.
You know, and they, you know, maybe take my picture.
Sure.
But from the very first time I went to one of these ceremonies, as female, with the same ribbons, and it was just, all of a sudden we weren't, I wasn't as, I hate to say, I would say important. I'll use that word.
Mm-hmm.
Other veterans that would come up and ask me where I serve. Nobody would take a picture. Nobody. I'm talking about the media, the people doing the presentation, other veterans. It was like I became invisible.
Invisible.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. And wearing and you know, exact same ribbons that as a man that people would, you know, and I just seen that grow more. You know, every year, especially it's like a more feminine.
As your public appearance,
yes,
became more effeminate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but wearing, I would wear the same battle ribbons in either a light black jacket or something, or one of the women's caps.
Mm-hmm.
The same as I pretty much did, you know, as John. And it's like people look right through you. I mean, they'll knock you over to go, you know, to shake some man's hand.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally somebody would say something, you know, say, well, gee, were you a nurse? But even that, I mean, it's so rare.
If somebody does ask you that nowadays, what do you reply to them?
Oh, that's kind of a personal quagmire for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it depends on my mood.
I'm sure. I can believe that.
I mean, sometimes I will say, yeah, I was training them. I'll try not to lie. And I'll say, well, I was training the medical corps, and I was sent over to Vietnam to be in the medical corps, and I ended up, then I'll say, well, yeah, I ended up serving a year in Vietnam as a clerk. And I'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
Other times, you know, if I get irritable, and somebody kind of, you know, gets on my nerves, you know, mm-hmm. some, you know, war stories are crap.
Right.
I'll say, well, actually, I served as male, and I served on a fire base on my ocean Buddha. And, you know, and people kind of go, whoa. But it's, either way, I just feel like, I don't know. The subject suddenly changes from, you know, transgender issues or basic gender issues, a woman can't do this.
Mm-hmm.
And either way, it's a, that a transgender woman is a woman, period. You know, I end up feeling slighted. You know, from other veterans and from the media. That women just do not get the same respect.
Are there other veterans organizations besides TAVA that you are or have been a member of during your post-transition life?
I'm still... Well, I'm a lifetime member of the Disabled American Veterans,
mm-hmm.
and I belong to an American Legion post, and I belong to VFW. You know, all three of them were issues over my discharge papers, which said, which you can't change, which do have me late with the name John,
yes.
Obviously male.
Yes.
You know, all three organizations, I went through a lot of paperwork and a lot of arguments to get them to change.
Get them to change your legal name?
Yeah.
Your name that's registered.
Right, like that. And, mm-hmm. you know, and respect my gender.
And
the VFW was one of the weirdest. For a year, they kept on sending my VFW magazines.
Yes.
But a label on it to Mrs. John Carney.
They just couldn't handle it.
Yeah, and even at first they had it to Mrs. Janice Carney, didn't they? Took me over a year and threatening a lawsuit, so I finally got. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you keep all the correspondence from those exchanges?
No, I didn't keep a lot of that stuff.
Okay.
But
the VFW was the most resistant. What about the Legion post? How did they react?
Down here, the commander acted really weird. He didn't know what to do.
I'm sure.
He just and. I kept on telling them, well, you just do it like you would do it with any married woman that has a DD. And that's pretty much what I tell a lot of them. Just follow whatever procedure you have for somebody that has a DD-214. Because it's the same thing if you're married. If you served under one name, then you've been married. Your DD-214 is still going to have your original name on
it. Sure, right.
So it's the same. It's the same procedure, whatever your procedure is for that.
Right, but that doesn't go down very well. They're not.
No, they kind of look at it and say, "Well, this is different. This is," and this guy really was. And I had a copy of my name change, a copy that I had surgery from the doctor, the court order.
Mm-hmm.
They're both court orders.
Mm-hmm.
And all you got to do is say, you know, you're refusing to follow a court order. I can. Especially with a name change and a court documentation that you had SRS surgery and illegally cisgender, both court documents, you present those for any reason where you're changing your name and your gender to anybody, anywhere,
right?
And they refuse to do it, they're in violation of a court order.
And you've had to explain this and go round and round about this?
Yeah, so many times, it's unbelievable.
I'll see
that. Well, it's funny at the American Legion post, though, with this guy, you know. Hey, well, I got to talk to the secretary. I don't know what to do with this. And the woman that handles all the paperwork, she just basically said, so what?
She said, so what?
You got the DD-14, you got the name change, you got... What's the issue? I mean, she just couldn't understand what his problem was. You get everything you need. There's no problem here. You're creating a problem.
Right. It would be interesting to hear him explain what his problem was, but he probably never had to offer an explanation of his position, whereas you constantly over and over had to explain your position, I'm sure.
And it just gets old. And
I'm sure.
And the caveat of it, which is, you know, the other issue is even if I'm involved in somebody's organization, you know, for a period of time, it's still this constant thing. Why you know, people are constantly saying, "Oh, your husband served at this." Or I can't. I lost count how many times I've heard that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, was your husband a Vietnam veteran? Oh, you know, are you in the auxiliary?
Right.
I mean, there still is this, and I think it's rapidly changing because of Iraq, more than ever. You know, women are serving in these combat support units.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And getting discharged. There was even Congress. What was his name? I can't think of his name. One of the congressmen or representatives just tried to push through a bill real quick to change the army and what military occupations women can serve in to restrict them in serving in the combat support unit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad that didn't fly.
Mm-hmm. Well, they're pretty tight for man or woman power right now.
I belong to the Service Members Legal Defense League, which is fighting to do away with the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy.
Yes. Uh-huh.
And I was trying to think. And the American Veterans for Equality, I remember that.
Mm-hmm. And so you're very actively publicly identifying yourself with your service to the country. I mean, it's so integral to who you are, at least in the public sense.
Yes, that's one of my... I actually wrestle with this at times, that I'm just so anti-war and pacifist type of person. But yet I'm proud of the fact that I served my country and want that recognition.
Mm-hmm.
It's just wasn't one of those things. And it's even when I went through all my transitioning, you know, from, you know, I don't know, male to female roles or whatever you want to, one of the things my therapist in Boston were constantly reminding me. I know that some things change, some things don't change. That even as I got more comfortable in being a female, I always knew I was. that you know, the stuff from Vietnam and certain things that were, you know, 50 years of my life were not going to go away.
That's right. Yeah.
And it's very, and at times it's very difficult for me to maintain both sides of my life. But I think I've learned quite a bit myself from meeting other women veterans.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, you can still have that devotion, and you can be some pretty tough women out there.
That's right. And I
sometimes fall into our society's traps that, well, you know, I'm this male, I always wanted to be this. And I, you know, sometimes stereotype myself as a female. It's kind of mind-boggling.
Well, it's a very, I think, important and interesting, historically important thing that you've done to share as much as you have with the Oral History Project of the Vietnam Archive, and I'm very grateful to you for all the time you spent. And I just want to ask one final thing, Janice. Is there anything that you would like to say in summary, or any observations you'd like to offer about any topic that I haven't asked you about in concluding the interview? I know I've taken you all over the place, and you've hung in there very, very well.
Yeah. One of the things that just popped into my head is an organization I didn't mention was American Veterans for Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a very important organization.
Are you affiliated with them?
Off and on. In fact, I've been trying to join the local chapter down here.
Uh-huh.
But I've spoken at some of their events in Boston and stuff.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And gone to different rallies, you know, protesting the war. But
the current war.
Yeah, the Iraqi
mm-hmm.
war.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, veterans are the greatest resource, war veterans particularly, on what war is like and what is really worth, you know, fighting and dying for.
Mm-hmm.
And we war veterans are the ones that are the only ones that can speak out. And I'm really, really, you know, hoping and drumming and meditating and praying that we start seeing some of these Iraqi veterans coming back, speaking out, you know, similar to the Vietnam veterans, you know, for peace did, that the Vietnam veterans against the war did.
Mm-hmm.
That if the veterans that came back from Vietnam that were disillusioned, off illusioned, because I looked at it,
mm-hmm.
that went to Senate hearings and spoke out about what was going on in there, and Vietnam could have gone on for another 10 years. Vietnam could have ended it like Korea, with a stalemate that seemed to never ending. I mean, to me, is the biggest thing. That veterans have got to speak in the public and tell what's really going on in these wars, especially letting the congressmen and the politicians know what's really going on over there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that's part of our issue. What the Pentagon represents to congressmen and legislators, and it's not necessarily what's really going on. And only the actual soldiers on the line, or whatever you want to call it, that have been in these wars can really, really educate the public.
And do you feel that's a responsibility that you have as a veteran, as well as a privilege and an opportunity?
I think it's a moral responsibility.
Okay.
That after what I saw in Vietnam and my knowledge of the history of the war, for me to sit back and what I see or perceive as history repeating itself, making the same mistakes.
In Iraq.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I'm morally obligated to speak out, and I think all Vietnam veterans that have similar feelings, if they sit back and don't say nothing, who can educate the public?
I think it's a good question, and something that other veterans, no doubt, will give greater consideration to, I think, as time goes on and as people study these interviews. Vietnam veterans have a lot to say about current and future foreign policy decisions, and particularly commitment of troops. So I thank you for your observations. And Janice, thank you also so much for all the time you've put into this.
You're quite welcome. It's been an experience.